from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. He made scientific history when he discovered a fossilized fish that was the missing link between land and sea creatures. And now paleontologist and popular science writer Neil Shubin is focusing his attention on the links between humans, rocks, and plants, and how clues to the universe's 14 billion year history can be found in our bodies. Shubin joins us to talk about his new book, The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. That's next on Forum, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Paleontologist Neil Shubin joins us in studio for this Forum hour. Popular science writer, is the author of the best-selling Your Inner Fish, which we discussed with him on Forum and which was selected back in 2009 by the National Academy of Sciences as the year's best book. He's Associate Dean of Biological Sciences at the University of Chicago, and he recently published a new book, The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, somehow I said plants, and meant planets, and people. Neil Shubin joins us for this morning's second hour. Good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get to something that may surprise some people. The history of the cosmos is in ourselves, about 14 billion years of the universe right there within us.
You bet. I mean, history is like a new pair of glasses. When you see history, you see the world in a whole new way. And that's true with our bodies. You know, when you see history inside of us, you see that each of our cells, organs, and genes contain over 3 billion years of the history of life, over 4 billion years of the history of the planet, and over 13 billion years of the history of the universe. And we see it as layer after layer inside of us. And so seeing history is like peeling an onion. And indeed, much of my quest in life is finding evidence for this history. And it's a really beautiful story inside of us.
Well, it's also a sense of the unity of all these physical entities that comes. I mean, I remember the old joke about the hot dog guy, the Zen Buddhist goes up to the hot dog guy in New York and says, make me one with everything. But you know, we keep talking about how interconnected we are in this interdependent age of ours of social networks. I mean, well, you know, planets, rocks, microbes, everything is kind of interdependent.
You bet. I mean, when you see history, you see our connections to the rest of life on our planet. That is, we're part of this giant tree of life. But then when you look deeper, you see our connections to physical entities, rocks, the solar system, and the universe itself. And our connections lie in the history we share with those things.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned rocks, and a lot of your work has been with rocks in paleontology. Tie us to the past. Rifts in the earth, you say, have left traces in our body, as they have in the crust of the planet.
You bet. So the continents have moved over a period of time, over hundreds of millions of years. That's one of the great revolutions in thinking, is seeing that our planet is so utterly dynamic. Mountains rise and fall, seas open and close, continents move about. But one of the beautiful things is the connections we see between the movement of those continents and the atmosphere and climate of our planet. Because one of the remarkable facts is the way that rock, air, water, and life are linked. And they're linked by the circulatory system of our planet, which is the water of our planet and the carbon and other atoms inside there. And so the carbon waxes and wanes in the air based on its interactions with rock and water. And so rifts, believe it or not, and plate tectonics, or the movement of the plates of the Earth, actually have an influence on atmosphere and climate and on life itself.
Well, this is a bit of a revelation. I mean, rocks we know because of the fossils and all are kind of time capsules, but our bodies are time capsules too, you say.
You bet. Time capsules and time capsules, and those time capsules are linked. And they're linked by the exchanges of atoms inside of them, and they're linked by the processes at work in the universe and solar system. So, I mean, simply, if you think about it, the atoms inside of us share a history with the universe, the Big Bang and stellar processes. The molecules inside of us share a history with the solar system and the planet. And indeed, the workings of the planet and the interactions of our planet with other planets in the solar system have really played a role in shaping us, which
is
remarkable.
Yeah, but read right from your book. Rocks and bodies are kinds of time capsules that carry the signature of great events that shape them. The molecules that compose our bodies arose in stellar events in the distant origin of the solar system. Changes to Earth's atmosphere sculpted our cells and entire metabolic machinery. Pulses of mountain building Changes in orbits of the planet and revolutions within Earth itself have had an impact on our bodies, minds, and the way we perceive the world around us.
Yeah, and you know, it was such a fun story to tell. I got to say. I mean, because I entered this as a paleontologist, right? I think about rocks and I look at rocks all the time. And when I'm up in the Arctic each summer, I spend hour after hour looking at rocks and thinking about stuff. And it occurred to me that, you know, by looking at rocks, that really has affected my view of life and the universe. And that's what this book's been about telling that story and connecting those seeming disconnects conceptually between, us and rocks? What are you talking about?
Well, you began by taking us into Greenland for some small fossils. I mean, the finding of a tooth becomes nothing short of a source of great celebration for you and Favis Jenkins from the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology. But you've also got that discovery just linked to, again, what you were looking for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one thing that people don't understand often about paleontology is they see fossil discovery as a kind of accident, you know, that we stumble on bones. No, it's kind of planned. And in fact, it's very planned. And we use the tools of evolutionary biology, we use the tools of geology to make predictions about likely and unlikely places to find fossils in the world. And so in our quest for early mammals, we were looking at the transition. This is when I was a young graduate student. We were looking at the transition between reptiles and mammals, and it became very clear that the best rocks to look at for our quest were 200-million-year-old rocks on the east side of Greenland. They had the right kinds of rocks of the right type, and they were exposed to the surface.
You knew exactly where to go, but you didn't know it was about, what, $3,000 per hour to get an Arctic helicopter?
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't know that.
I mean, on an academic budget?
That's a kind of a killer. I'm used to beat up pickup trucks.
Well, these kinds of discoveries, I mean, your discovery with the inner fish and everything have led us to a much deeper understanding of evolutionary processes. A lot of your work, though, I must say, having back in the day interviewed Stephen Jay Gould a number of times, you have the ability to make these stories very clear to us. Write about tough science for the lay audience, which is no small feat.
Well, my tack is actually that I imagine myself having a conversation with my father as I write. I mean, this is really true. And my father is an educated man, but is kind of phobic of science. And so I imagine I'm talking to Dad. And, you know, it helps a lot. Sometimes it gives me incredible writer's block.
It wouldn't work for me. My dad loves science, but if I had to write about literary things, he would be gone.
But it forces me to be a little more storytelling and explanatory the narrative that I use. It slows me down a little bit. And it always forces me to ask the question, is this comprehensible to someone who doesn't have the jargon in the background that I have gained over a number of years?
It's a great gift from your dad. I mean, he provides you with that audience. I think it was Kurt Vonnegut who said the best way to write is to write for strangers because they don't understand the way you think or the way your language, you know, comes forward.
Yeah, the dad in my brain does argue back from time to time.
Called you superego. More of our organs are shaped by the workings of the planets and even actions of the sea, like, kidneys, for example.
You bet. I mean, if you think about the interactions with the solar system, there's some really fabulous examples here. One of them is one of the great stories is that in every cell of our body, we have a clock inside of it. And that clock exists in the working of DNA and proteins. And the cycling of that, you know, the rising and falling of that activity of the DNA and proteins functions as a clock that exists as like a kind of a pendulum. And it waxes and wanes on not just any random cycle. It waxes and wanes on a virtual 24-hour cycle. So think of it. Inside every cell of our body, that is 2 trillion cells, have clocks inside of them. So we have 2 trillion clocks inside our bodies, and our health depends on those clocks in many ways. Those are very fundamental biochemical processes inside of us. I mean, we have susceptibility to diseases that are based on disruptions of those clocks. And those clocks are shared among all animals in many ways, flies and hamsters and people. And they're tuned to a planetary cycle. They're tuned to the spinning of the Earth and the rotation of the moon. Indeed, some organisms have tidal clocks inside of them. So we have inside of us, that is part of our own health and guides the working of our organs, a tuning to the rotation of the Earth, the night and day cycles that exist. And that's one of the most fundamental biological properties of life on our planet, at least life on our planet that's close to the surface.
Is it like menstruation and the moon?
Menstruation is on a monthly cycle. We have other creatures that have a tidal cycle. We tend to have two kinds of clocks inside of us. One is a diurnal cycle. We also have a seasonal cycle. Think about seasonal affective disorder. I mean, I know that from Chicago, where I live. But we also have seasonal variation. If you look at crime rates and other things, there's a seasonal variation to those things.
Not necessarily with a full moon, though. I think that's been dispelled as such as urban legend.
Yeah, this isn't astrology or anything like that.
No, but I mean, a lot of people believe it. There's a full moon. There's going to be more violence because the numbers of violent acts seem to go up or something. But you've also let me ask you kind of directly, what in our bodies derive, say, from the supernova?
Well, if you think about what's inside our bodies, we have a variety of atoms, the matter that makes us, that composes us, that I'm using to talk to you with right now and you're using to hear me with right now. The smallest nuclei of those atoms came as a direct result of the moments after the Big Bang. But then after that, as you make heavier and heavier nuclei and atoms, you know, marching up the periodic table, you know, from, you know, carbon to oxygen and ever bigger all the way up to iron and so forth, heavier and heavier ones are produced in the fusion reaction of stars. The largest of those, the heaviest ones, actually require a supernova explosion to make because of the physics of what's going on inside their nuclei. So it's a truism to say that the matter that composes us arose in the distant reaches of the universe and the stellar fusion reactions of stars and in supernovae, and that congealed in us, and then after we pass, after we die, our atoms will return to the universe, and in some point in billions of years in the future may be part of other worlds, other systems, indeed other supernovae. I mean, it's an amazing thought, and it's one that's very well supported by science.
And does it matter when we go back to the Big Bang that now we have people like Stephen Hawking saying, well, gravity preceded the Big Bang?
No, it really doesn't, because what it means is it doesn't change the story of where the materials that make us come from. It explains how those materials may have come about in physically. But indeed, you know, gravity has been a real shaper of our world, and it's been a real shaper of the stellar fusion processes that drive the nuclear reactions. But it's also a shaper of our interactions with the planet, right? I mean, we're a certain size and shape because of the size and shape of the Earth itself.
Talking with Neil Shubin, his new book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. And our body temperature reminds us, you say, of how plate tectonics can influence evolution. How does that work?
You bet. We have a very high metabolic temperature. We humans rely on a high energy lifestyle. That is, you know, we have warm-bloodedness, that core, and we have a big brain. All these things need fuel.
Bigger brain in males, so it doesn't always seem that
way. Well, bigger brains, you know, relative to other creatures too, relative to our body size as well. And what that requires is a high-energy lifestyle that is fueled by atomic processes. And one of the key ingredients of this fuel for that lifestyle is oxygen itself, because oxygen, through its structure, provides the context for exchanges of electrons, which are the fuel for those exchanges of electrons between atoms and molecules are the processes that fuel this high energy lifestyle. So the origin of our high energy lifestyle to many is tied to the origin of a rich oxygen environment, which itself is tied to perhaps the rifting that happened 200 million years ago as the continent split apart to make the Atlantic Ocean. So there's a case where the oxygen in the atmosphere may be related to the rifting of the continents 200 million years ago, and the oxygen in the atmosphere is related to our own biology itself. So again, these things are tied.
Yeah, in fact, you write about North America and Europe once being joined by an extensive mountain range, which of course a lot of people can't conceive of.
Yeah, so my first expedition was in Nova Scotia, Canada, and we were finding virtually identical fossils to what people were finding in Morocco at the time. And the reason for that is you could have walked from New Jersey, Nova Scotia, all the way to Fez, Morocco, without hitting the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, when you think about a change like that, the movement of the continents, you're changing the Earth, you're changing the atmosphere, you're changing climates in such a way that that's bound to impact bodies, and indeed the records, the artifacts lie inside of us.
You write a lot in this book also about scientific discoveries and about some of the ways those discoveries came about. It's really serves as a kind of guide to some of the bigger discoveries and just how accidental and lucky they can be, but also how they come from hard work and diligence, as anybody can recognize. But the fact is, you write about catastrophic events too in shaping the Earth, and some of those who have read this book have said, why did he leave out global warming? And why did you leave out
global warming? Global warming is very much a part of the book. It's a shaper of us. Indeed, it is the context in which global warming and cooling through carbon and changes in carbon is very much a part of the perspective of the book
itself. I think maybe they wanted some muckraking.
They wanted some. Yeah, they wanted to say, well, we're raising carbon. And I mean, there are other books that do that very well.
That was not in your...
there are other books that do that.
That was not for your father to read.
No, I mean, it's not because of any... frankly, my take on global warming is honed by my experience in the Arctic. When I went to the Arctic 2 years ago on a paleontological expedition, my jaw dropped. Because my beloved Arctic was changing. We didn't see any ice in places we've seen ice for the last 25 years. The Inuit themselves have changed their lifestyles. I mean, to go to the Arctic and see what's going on there is frankly alarming. And indeed, there was a news report just a few days ago talking about how the Arctic has really been the warming, the tip of the spear in global warming. And that's indeed my own experience.
So talk a little bit, if you could, about the relationship of catastrophic events, when we go back in time to shaping the Earth.
Well, they're sort of game changers in a really big way, because if you take – let's just do a thought experiment. Let's say you take every fossil we've ever found and lay it in some sort of temporal series in front of you. You know, you'd probably have an area the size of San Francisco, the metropolitan area here. Certain patterns would emerge. And some people have made careers out of analyzing these patterns quantitatively. But one of those patterns you don't need any statistics to really see is that there are certain time periods, about five of them, where species from around the world go extinct relatively rapidly. Some of them are larger than others, but these are known as the mass extinctions of life. These have really been game changers.
Like the dinosaurs.
And there's been others as well. Indeed, there was one, the Permo-Triassic extinction, as it's called, happened about 250 million years ago or so. And that, by some calculations, led to the demise of over 96% of species in the oceans. So these have really changed the context. And what happens is you remove some species in these extinction events and others flourish. What came about is that these catastrophes have been shapers of life on Earth, and indeed the search for mechanisms of these catastrophes has been a very active area of scientific inquiry. We all know about the asteroid impact hypothesis, which seems to be the likely cause for the demise of dinosaurs over 65 million years ago and other creatures.
It's always been questionable in my mind, that asteroid theory, mainly because of the fact that it would have possibly killed off a lot of other species too, including perhaps Homo sapien.
Well, Homo sapiens weren't around at that time. But the thing about that is,
well, what were they? They were Java men, or
no? They were tiny little mammals living at the feet of the dinosaurs,
like Lucy.
No, even this is 65 million years ago. We're dealing with creatures like the size of a small shrew, maybe a little bit bigger. But you touch on an important point. That is, what are the properties that enable an animal or plant or an organism to survive one of these catastrophes? And many of my colleagues have looked at this quantitatively. You know, you kind of can measure stuff. You can, you know, is it how fast they run? Is it their energetic lifestyle?
We have our metrics, yeah.
Yeah. The property that seems to be most important seems to be whether how distributed across the globe the species or the groups of organisms are. It's their geographic distribution and the context of that geographic distribution, nothing related to their performance. So what that means, if that is true, that means that your survivorship of one of these catastrophes, that is, these catastrophes that shaped indeed our own presence on this planet, is sort of random with regard to how well you were doing before the catastrophe, you know, in terms of like your normal adaptation. So in a sense, those are game changers. And there are those who believe that the removal of the dinosaurs was every bit as important in shaping our lineage's existence on this earth as our own parents, to many sense. So we wouldn't be here without them.
Talking again with Neil Shubin. His new book is The Universe Within, and I'm going to invite those of you listening to join us in this conversation. You may have some thoughts to put into the mixture here of talk that we're doing, or you may indeed have some questions or just general comments, and we do welcome hearing from you. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org. Post any questions or comments you have on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and we welcome your involvement, so feel free to join us. Again, the new book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. And I should mention that Neil Shubin will be appearing live this evening in San Francisco at the Jewish Community Center. He'll be there at 7 o'clock. So an opportunity to meet the author, but you can talk with him now on the air with us. What do you see going back? I mean, the missing link that you worked out with the inner fish was, I call it a missing link, it was a missing link, was very important, was singularly important. But what led up to the kind of links that you've been able to make as a paleontologist? I mean, because you have so many in here of these discoveries, scientific discoveries, were again, game changers.
Yeah, what really, I mean, the game changers are the ones that enabled us to see the world in new ways. And there were certain people who in collecting their data and looking at the world, gave us a new window to it. Astronomers who gave us new ways to think about light in the sky. I mean, just think about it. You look at the stars in the sky. How do you know how far apart those things are? How do you know how fast they're moving away from us? What's happening in that sky? What's a galaxy? I mean, when you look at a sky, you just see dots and fuzzy patches. But it's people who learned to see in new ways, learned to see that light as a ruler in the sky or a radar gun in the sky.
Well, I'm thinking there's a poem by Adrian Rich about Carolyn Herschel, the astronomer who didn't get a lot of the credit, you know, because she was a woman, for many of her discoveries. And Adrian Rich says, "What we see, and seeing is changing."
That's so true, because so much of my work as a paleontologist and so much of astronomers' work in doing what they do is learning to see. I spend a lot of time learning to see. I spend a lot of time learning to see inside of rocks, and that means training my eye, but also training my brain. That is, you know, having the conceptual apparatus to understand history, but then training my eye to actually physically to see the patterns that are inside the rocks, you know, that little glint of bone inside a complex rock. So, I mean, the heroes of the stories I tell are usually the people who've learned to see both conceptually and physically in a new way.
Well, I saw you on Colbert. Many other people may have as well. And he was saying, you know, rocks? What do we have to do with rocks? You know, I mean, he was playing that usual Colbert persona and everything. For many people's minds, the idea... They can get their mind around the idea that there's a fossil that can be revelatory about the human condition and about history, but the idea that we are linked to rocks seems, you know, rocks are dumb things. They're things that have no life to them. So,
yeah, but the rocks have so much inside. Let's just take, you know, every rock on the ground has a story to tell. The story of what the world looked like when it was formed at that part of the world. And some of them tell us about more than just one patch of the world. They can tell us about large swaths of the world. Take some rocks from over a billion years ago. Those rocks from some places in the world have a kind of rust inside of them that is an indicator of the rise in oxygen in the atmosphere at that time period. That rise in oxygen, it's thought, is to be related to one of the great transitions in the history of life, which is the origin of multicellular life, when single cells came together to make a complex bodied organism. So there's a connection between the rust and rocks and the processes that hold bodies together that's seen through the rise in oxygen that we shared with the planet, our lineage at least, billions and years
ago. There's our consanguinity with rocks right
there. Exactly.
Yeah, we're talking to Neil Shubin. And please feel free to join us. We're coming up on a break, but we will hear from you when we return. And you can join the conversation now by dialing in at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking the segment. And I should mention again that Neil Shubin made scientific history when he discovered a fossilized fish that was the missing link that I referred to before between land and sea creatures. And now the paleontologist and popular science writer is focusing his attention on links between humans, rocks, and planets, and how clues to the universe's 14 billion year history can be found in our bodies. He'll be at the JCC in San Francisco this evening at 7 p.m. And again, the book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Neil Shubin is spending the hour with us, professor, paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and popular science writer. He's at the University of Chicago Department of Organismal Biology and Anatomy, and his new book is called The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. In 2004, he discovered a fossilized fish called Tiktaalik, the missing link between fish and land animals. And we talked with him about that, and now we're talking with him about all this interconnectivity between us and Well, rocks, planets, and people. And let's go to your calls. And by the way, you can join us a number of ways besides our toll-free number. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or to our Facebook page. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And, Ed, we begin with you. Good morning.
Hi, Michael Seed. How are you?
Hi.
I like to bring one of the most fascinating characteristics of this whole universe, aside from the Big Bang, is water. Water has four characteristics which we can't really explain. Of course, it is due, it's a V-shape of the molecule instead of being bar-like, like H2S, which freezes at minus 40 degrees. Water freezes at minus zero. According to that predictable location, it should freeze at minus 200 degrees, but it freezes at zero centigrade or about because of the V-shape of the molecule. Number two, when it freezes, it expands. Without that, life would not have started, because most of us believe life started in water. And if the ice freezes at the bottom, you'll never have life a chance. Second, it has the highest specific heat, so it takes a lot of heat to heat it up and a lot of heat to cool it down, take the heat out. Third is it has very high latent heat. It takes a long time to convert it to steam or to freeze it to ice. To take heat out. The last thing is that it's the most universal solvent. You can solve more things in water than you can do in other molecules.
All right, so water, heat, solvent.
These are all really important points. The water molecule, as you said, is called the universal solvent because so many things dissolve in it. And it exists in different phases across a narrow range, relatively narrow range of temperatures. And the water molecule itself is almost shaped like Mickey Mouse ears. You have a face with two ears popping off of it, which gives it a polarity between a negative and a positive side. All those properties make it a wonderful matrix for the Earth. And the thing, when you think about water, water is an important part of our own circulatory system, carrying molecules around across our bodies, but it is very much a part of the circulatory system of our planet. That water is part of the exchange of atoms between rock, air, and life, and the internal workings of the Earth itself. So it's those properties which, at the level of life and mineral, that make water very important.
And it's becoming more precious and more privatized.
Yeah, and where does the water come from? That's one of the, how did the water in our planet get here? And that's one of the neat questions that cosmologists...
Well, when we're exploring Mars, we hope to find some of that, at least...
And if you think about the water, there are many theories, and there's a lot of data coming out showing that maybe there are multiple sources. There's a geochemical signature, a chemical signature of the water on the planet, in the oceans, and you see that signature in some comets, but not all. We see some of that signature in some asteroids, but probably not all. And the water may have come from being squeezed out of the minerals itself as the Earth formed. So there are many potential sources, all of them from our solar system, for the origin of the water on our planet.
A lot of those asteroids are pretty icy, though.
Yeah, they are. Indeed.
And let me go to some calls. And Chuck, you're next. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just stepping off of your comment about success of species during mass extinctions being kind of random. What's your perspective on the development of the layers of the human brain and how that's been driven by our planetary environment?
You bet. So if you look at brains, there's several stories to tell in terms of their connections. The first level of connections lie in the structure of the physical entities of our brains themselves. So the overall layout of our brain, having a forebrain, midbrain, and hindbrain, is a fundamental property of many animals.
Just give a plug tomorrow. Deepak Chopra is on with us, and he's got a new book about the brain.
Well, one thing I hope he talks about is our connection to other animals and the structure of our brains and their genetics. It turns out that some of the basic architecture of our brains is seen in the genetic architecture, at least, is seen in things like flies and some kinds of worms and so forth. Now, in terms of brains themselves, brains are really expensive metabolically. It's a hungry organ for energy. So much of our origin of brains relates not only to the advantages that that are accrued by having such a large brain and the new opportunities it provides for us and the new ways that we it can evolve and can change independent of Darwinian evolution. We can learn and have cultural exchange. But it also that relates to, what is the new energetic context? What are things that are going on in terms of the planet itself that are happening as increase, our brains increase. There are changes that are happening at the time of human origins, and that is there's dramatic changes in East Africa with the changes from woodlands to grasslands. We're having the opening up of the woodlands to grasslands. There's lots of climatic variation happening in that East African area, and that climatic variation, as well as the opening from woodlands to grasslands, is related to changes in thought to be related to changes in ocean circulation, to changes in the rise and fall of the glaciers, some of which are related to the changes in our Earth's orbit during this time period. That is, our Earth has regular variations in its orbit, and called Milankovitch cycles, and these are related to our interactions with Jupiter and other planets. And
now Jupiter plays a pretty strong role here, in fact, doesn't it?
Yeah, Jupiter's a star of a lot of the show here in our own our own changes, and it's in part related to the rise and fall of the glaciers, which is in part related to some of the changes in the origin of humans.
And speaking about the origins of humans, let me thank Chuck for the call. I'll go to more calls in just a moment here, but. I mean, we know our DNA is pretty close to, say, chimpanzees and primates, the whole simian family, but it's also pretty close to just about everything, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the amazing thing we've learned in the last 30 years. As we compare our DNA to creatures, we begin to see this family tree. We can begin to see, you know, the same techniques we use to look at our family tree. We can begin to see how that family tree extends first to primates, then to other mammals, then to things we call reptiles, then to things we call amphibians and fish, and on and on and on. Our family tree extends just deeply all the way to microbes. You know, that's amazing.
Here's a listener who says, I can't believe Michael thought some Homo sapiens were around with the dinosaurs like in the Flintstones, a real Sarah Palin moment. You know, thinking about some of the precursors to human beings and... Okay. Maybe I've seen too many movies or too many Flintstone-type shows. Another listener writes, I'd love to hear some more specific examples of how you see the history of these events within our bodies. Much of the conversation has been very general, and I'm not even really sure what discoveries the guest has made or what the evidence is.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, let's just take the glaciation story. So there's a situation where, you know, we know that the rise and fall of the glaciers is related to large-scale biological change in our planet and related to the flourishing of the human lineage over 3 million years ago. That is, there's a major change that happened back at that time. The rise and fall of the glaciers is itself related to the variations of the Earth's orbit that happen over regular intervals. I would say 22,000 years, 44,000 years, 100,000 years. There are cycles in the changes of Earth's orbit. The cycles in the changes of Earth's orbit are related to its interactions with other planets in the solar system. So there's a daisy chain of connections and cause that are seen in the flourishing of our own bodies.
Another listener writes, could you please ask your guest whether he has read 1,000 Years of Nonlinear History by Manuel de Landa, and if so, how it influenced his thinking? Some of the themes of the two authors overlap.
No, there are whole libraries filled with books I haven't read, I'm afraid to say.
Let me go to more calls, and we go next to Billy in San Jose. Hi, Billy.
Oh, hi. I have a quick question for the guest, and then I'll listen to his answer off the air. I wondered if, Mr. Schumann, if you believe that the Earth is currently in the midst of or on the brink of one of the major extinction events of the type that you discussed. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that question. There is no doubt in my mind. And in fact, knowing something about history gives context to what's going on today. And it's almost inescapable. I mean, if you look at the changes in environments around the globe, if you look at species diversity around the globe, and you correlate that to human impacts, everything from our impact on the climate to habitat destruction to coastal development to other kinds of things that affect species habitat loss, it's sort of inescapable that there's an extinction going on now and that humans are playing a very, very large role in that extinction event.
Well, I mean, the catastrophic events that you write about almost seem in a linear way to bring us up to climate change, whatever we want to call global warming, the kind of carbon footprint that is leading us perhaps toward planetary extinction.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing when you look at cosmic history and planetary history is you really see what a game changer human brains have been. Because, you know, let's say I talked about the origin of this oxygen atmosphere that is captured in our bodies in terms of the cells that came together, how the rise in oxygen billions of years ago is related to multicellularity, the origin of bodies. Well, that took trillions of algae, billions of years to produce that oxygen and other geological events to help it out as well. But now we can have changes that come about by human ideas traveling at the speed of light on radio programs, on the internet, and so forth, where collectively the decisions we make and the ideas we have can literally change the planet. You know, and that is truly a game changer. Okay, that's something our planet has not seen before. So when your caller was asking about, you know, this sixth extinction, as some are fun, or some call it, I mean, it's clearly related to this new game changer, which is human ideas and our capacity to evoke enormous changes that don't necessarily span generations, but span the trading of ideas among individuals who can behave collectively in certain ways.
Again, our guest in studio is Neil Shubin, the author of Your Inner Fish, and his new book is The Universe Within, and we'll get more of your calls on. We go to Dave. Dave, you're on.
Hi. Hey, I'm just wondering about the whole understanding of evolution here, with the understanding that there's millions and millions and millions of fossils being found and they've discovered, but there's not one. Seems like to me, I haven't seen it yet, a proof of evidence that this one creature, let's say of a fish, had transformed into some kind of lizard-like creature. There's no evidence of this evolution of fish changing into lizards and lizards changing into bears, or that I'm related to a chimpanzee or anything, because there's no fossilization that has proof of that. And so it's I'm wondering about how you explain the macro level of evolution versus the micro level of evolution, which is the changing and adaptation to its environment, versus that I'm a related species of a giraffe, or I'm a related species to a piece of sludge that evolved from a single cell organism to this now more complex multi-level organism, and where the evidence is for any of that evolution to evolve.
Where's the proof?
Okay, well, thanks for that question. So, first off, I wouldn't expect evidence for a fish to transform into a lizard or you to transform into a bear, because we really have finer stages we look at. But, you know, the whole idea of evolution and the whole practice of being an evolutionary biologist is the quest for evidence, making predictions, testing those predictions, and finding evidence for our hypotheses. We have some incredibly robust hypotheses of evolution, and we have some that are less robust. It's a human enterprise. Now, let's just take the example of the fish to tetrapod transition, the transition from, you know, finned animal to limbed one over 375 million years ago. My colleagues, Ted Deschler and Farish Jenkins, and I used the principles of evolutionary biology, used the principles of geology to make a very specific prediction that somewhere in the Canadian Arctic, in rocks about 375 million years old, we should find a creature that has scales on its back and fins with fin webbing. And that's exactly what we found. But that creature also had a flat head with eyes on top, like an early limbed animal, and fins that, when we took them apart, had bones that correspond to the upper arm, forearm, even parts of our wrist. So that is an intermediate between life in water and life on land. That creature had both lungs and gills, much like living lungfish today. So what we have is a real amphibious stage there. And it's not just the fact of the fossil itself that it exists, because if I show it to you, you'd say, oh, wow, that does look like a cross between, you know, a fish and an early land living animal. It's a physical object that, you know, that is sort of unambiguous in that way. But what's even more important was the predictive power of the evolutionary tools that got us there in the first place. And so that shows the conceptual power. Now, to answer your question about, you know, you and me being related to primates and giraffes and sludge, the evidence there lies in our DNA, in thousands upon thousands of base pairs that lie in our DNA that carry the signature of the tree of life. These same techniques we use to determine paternity tests, to identify family identity, and those same techniques we can extend in the fossil record, with a little modification, but not much, to tell us about the tree of life and how we're related to those things. So what we have is, when we look at the tree of life, seeing in the DNA, seeing in the fossils, seeing in embryos, seeing in the genes that drive embryonic development from a single egg to adult, we find a correspondence of evidence together that is oftentimes very beautiful, and that really shows us things that are counterintuitive. That is, we have cousins alive on the Earth today, and they're all our cousins. That as our closest cousins are primates, our distant, very distant cousins, like, as you say, are sludge, and and somewhere in the middle lie giraffes. And
you talk about a whole constellation of evidence. Nevertheless, you hear people who are not necessarily creationists who will say, well, I look at human beings and I look at giraffes and sludge and I don't see, just visually, again, it's seeing. I don't see where the connection is.
Yeah, it's learning to see. It's learning to use the evidence and find it. And one other thing is don't ever underestimate. We have large puzzles out there in evolution. I'd be out of a job if we didn't have questions to ask. I'm a scientist. It's about discovery. And so we have many powerful hypotheses, but there are many things we have yet to discover, too.
Elizabeth writes, what does Mr. Shubin think about the idea suggested by Animal Planet's Mermaids, The Body Found, which talked about the possibility of apes being driven to live in the ocean and evolving to breathe and see underwater?
No, I'm not really sure about the aquatic theories of those, because if you look at the fossil evidence and you look, again, it's about the evidence. If you look about where we find the fossils, if you look about what the traits they have, it doesn't support notions like that.
Another listener says, can Neil Shubin talk about the impact of non-physical things like spirituality, emotion, and intelligence on the physical world?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things when you look about the human experience, the human experience is driven by ideas. It's driven by aesthetics. It's driven by spirituality. We're complicated creatures. We're game-changing creatures. And those decisions we make as a result of those inputs change the world. Okay, and that's my take on it. Now, when you ask about, you know, spirituality, it's hard to escape the fact that, you know, science leads you to see the grand connections among life on our planet and among life to other objects in the solar system. And there's an aesthetic to that. I find that not just well-supported, but I find it incredibly beautiful that, you know, not only are we, you know, have a shared relationship with other animals, but we're truly citizens of the universe right down to our matter.
This may be more of a question for tomorrow's guest, Deepak Chopra, but I'll read it for you. Sarah from Berkeley says, mystics and healers have made this link between rocks, crystals, and humans for millions of years for healing purposes for humans. What does your guest think of the notion of humans gaining healing from rocks, that is, using healing crystals for a myriad of ailments?
Well, that I cannot comment on because I'm not expert on this.
A little bit outside of your bailiwick. Yeah. Well, another listener asks, any chance we would run out of original Earth materials for research?
Well, I hope not. Hopefully not in my lifetime. No, I mean, what it turns out is actually that there is so much still to discover. That's why students in paleontology nowadays, students in geology nowadays, they've never had it better in some ways because more areas of the Earth are accessible to their study. There are new techniques they can use to study fossils. You know, we can now use a sort of a CT scanner to see inside rocks in certain ways. Geologists have powerful new chemical tools that tell us about what the ancient worlds looked like. We have human laboratories on other planets, the Mars Curiosity rover with its own geochemical laboratory up there. I mean, there's very exciting times to study rock, and it's an exciting time to find fossils there. In fact, we're going out this summer to find more fossils.
Where are you going?
Going back to the Arctic. We're going to be looking at rocks slightly older than the tectonic ones.
I hope you can afford those helicopters this time. You know, through the years, I've interviewed people like I mentioned before, Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins, and on a continuum, they kind of see evolution differently, I mean, to put it mildly. I mean, for Gould, it was much more random, really, randomness involved, and I think Dawkins, who sees things, with a lot less randomness. Where do you put yourself?
Well, you know, it's funny. When you talk about, you know, I think where you're going with that is, you know, if you replayed the tape of life over the last, you know, billions of years,
that's exactly
is humans inevitable?
Right.
Are humans inevitable? You know, and that's a question. I'll say, what would be the, again, evidence? What would be the evidence to show that? Well, my favorite form of evidence would be if a spaceship landed on the planet and it had aliens that looked exactly like us, and they had on that spaceship a museum containing every fossil from their planet that shows a parallel evolution, if you will, you know, to a similar body form. That would show that there's an inevitability in different worlds mm-hmm. of a human body form. Well, we don't have that. But what we do have are knowledge of the fossil record, and we have a knowledge of development. Part of it shows incredible randomness, and part of it shows that there is a degree of predictability to evolution. If you look at the randomness piece of it, the mass extinction piece really lends a degree of randomness, that, you know, the survivorship of a mass extinction is random with regard to how well you were doing before of a catastrophe. So those seem to be game changers that are sort of roll of the dice kind of things. But embedded in that is more of a predictability to evolution, because the more we study developmental processes, embryology, the genes that drive that, the more we find that there's a common recipe, you know, DNA-based recipe for many different organs. And that common recipe sometimes leads to similar outputs. So you can have common anatomical features arising separately in different groups of creatures. So we live in a world of both contingency and predictability. And I think our evolution has been shaped by both of those. So I fall sort of in the middle of that because I think our very presence on Earth is probably related to more of a randomness and contingency.
It's a good safe place to be. Actually, speaking about, you sort of alluded to exobiology. Here's Lou, who says, can you ask your guest if any of his work points to future remote sensing that could be used to protect life on other planets?
To protect life?
To protect.
That's what we have on, Mars Curiosity rover. So life, when we want to find evidence of life, we can look for fossils, right? You can see the shapes of the creatures that exist. But also life leaves the geochemical signature. It leaves a chemical signature in the rocks because life has a metabolism and interacts with the chemicals in the atmosphere, and it'll change the local rocks. So the signature that I think that if we will find for life may not be, cracking a rock and seeing this giant, fossil inside of it. It'll be more a chemical signature showing that there was some form of metabolism going on of a microbial creature. And the hope is perhaps something like that exists on Mars or other worlds.
Devin in Berkeley, could you ask your guest what his thoughts are on collective consciousness? Are there any scientific studies that support this idea? In his opinion, will we learn to communicate with trees and rocks in the future?
Well, I don't know about talking to trees and rocks, honestly. But collective consciousness, I think, in terms
that's a Jungian idea. Actually.
Yeah, very much so. I can't really comment on that. But at the basis of our interactions with the biosphere and the physical world lie our deep connections with those.
Let me get more calls on, and we go to you, Dan. Hi.
Yes, hi. One of your previous callers was talking about finding actual evidence of us going from fish to mammals and things like that. And one of the most amazing experiences that I remember was in the visitor center at Point Reyes National Seashore, I think it was at Drake's Beach. They actually have a whale skeleton, a rather large one, about 25 feet up, hanging from the ceiling. And suspended among all those bones are two little bones in the back of the part of the whale that once were the pelvis bones of that whale, which are just suspended there, not doing anything now. But it's a remnants of when the whale was actually a four-legged mammal on the earth. So it's an example of not necessarily going from a fish to a four-legged beast, but from a four-legged beast back to a mammal that lives in water. So pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's a really good insight because, when you look at the, water to land shift, it's actually happened a few times in both directions, right? So, plants have made the transition from water to land. Invertebrates made it. Our distant ancestors, the vertebrates made it, the creatures with skeletons. But then we've seen it go the other way, right? And multiple times. Reptiles have done it several times. Mammals have done it. And in each case, you can follow the transition in the anatomies that you see, such as what we call the, quote, vestigial or rudimentary structures, like the one you pointed out in the pelvis of that whale.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Dan. Good to hear from you. And let's go to another caller. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Hi. Oh, I'm sorry. Is this Bill in Roseville?
Well, I don't know. I don't see your name here, but you're talking about porcupines?
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, my question is, the human brain has evolved to give us a pretty profound advantage on our competitors, for survival. Why haven't other creatures, whether it be giraffes or porcupines or whatever, why haven't they mutated into larger brains and given them a profound advantage? Why is it just humans or just primates, I guess, that have made use of this advantage? I mean, with natural selection, you would think all creatures at one point or another, developed larger brains, and why wasn't that larger brain given an advantage that would make it more profound throughout the planet?
Yeah, good question. Well, other creatures do have large brains. If you look at dolphins, for instance, they have large brains for their body size.
Well, they do. They have more convolutions on their brains than we do, in fact,
exactly.
Which is usually linked to intelligence.
Yeah, so we're not alone there. But I think you bring up the good question. Why don't certain features, if they seem so good, why haven't they appeared more often? And you have to realize that every feature has costs and benefits associated with it. We're focusing on the benefits of the brain. We're sharing that right now, right? The conversation we all are having and the ideas that we're exchanging with one another. But there's also costs to that that exist. It's an amazingly expensive organ. And so it has to come about in the right set of circumstances, and those are both planetary and biological, and they all existed several million years ago in East Africa.
We thank you for the call. Let me try to get another caller on here, and that's Lisa.
Lisa.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question. I'm curious if you have any comments about the Gaia theory.
Yes. I mean, the Gaia theory at its core has, I think, a very important observation.
It's the Mother Earth theory.
Yeah. That is that there is a deep connection between living creatures, the atmosphere, the rocks, and the water of the planet. And at that level, I think that we really see a powerful interconnectivity, that they change together. The change in one can affect the other. The Gaia theory takes it one step further, which says that this is akin to a living organism. I don't quite take it that far, but I definitely agree very deeply in the interconnections among all those entities of the biosphere and the physical Earth.
And we thank you, Lisa, for your call, and we thank you, Neil Shubin, for spending this delightful hour with us. Congratulations on the new book, and continue turning them out.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And again, his book is The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People. He's also the author of Inner Fish. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And we certainly enjoy hearing from you, so feel free to let us know your thoughts about what you've heard or what you'd like to hear. We're here with you, as I said, Monday through Friday, and we're produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.